From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we bring you the eighth in a series of conversations with Professor Luciana Bone, looking at the construction of the state and economy of the USSR. We began with the 1917 revolution, and thus far have come through the period ending in approximately 1932.
So, to recap, from 1928 to 1933, with the industrial policies of Stalin's five-year plan, which included collectivization, rapid industrialization, and centralized planning, the industrial complexes grew, unemployment went virtually down to zero, the urban population increased to 30 million, engineers were sent abroad to learn industrial technology, and hundreds of foreign engineers were brought to Russia to work on contract. Workers who exceeded their production quota, the Stakhanovists or Vites, received many incentives for their work. So they could afford to buy goods that were mass-produced by the Soviet economy, which was in rapid expansion. So one thing to note is that this progress was achieved relying on the internal forces without credits and loans from abroad. So Stalin had made it clear that in setting up its heavy industry, the Soviet state could not follow the road which the capitalists take, which is loans from other countries or plunder other countries. To continue the recap, then quality of life improved.
Yeah, it's significantly, as a matter of fact, it improved.
Significantly, indeed.
Yeah.
So we know that workers needed to be literate, so the number of schools increased. In fact, the generation born under the Stalin government was the first almost fully literate. As we know, women received equal education, equal rights to employment, and they were the first generation of women able to give birth safely in hospitals. So the Stalin period saw the advancement of health, increased life expectancy, universal access to education and healthcare. Transportation also improved with the construction of many new railways. Now, that's pretty much recapping, but one thing to note, too, is the following. The multinational nature of the state, the republics in beyond the Urals, was strengthened, and the Caucasus. Importantly, subsidies flowed to the outlying republics to speed up their industrialization. So Lenin had called the Tsar's empire the prison of peoples. So Lenin and Stalin supported the nationalism of Soviet republics in Asia and the Caucasus. They saw the nationalism of non-Russian republics as an ally in establishing the worker state. So, in fact, they were the first statesmen to institute a policy of affirmative action.
That's right.
For the national peoples.
Right.
Of the Soviet republics, encouraging the cultural care and retention of their languages, instituting publishing presses, promoting libraries, conference, and education in native languages. So, to conclude this part then, after collectivization, modern agriculture was built up with the support of a powerful base of agricultural machinery produced by heavy industry. And thus the problem of grain and other principal agricultural and livestock products was solved. No, it was Stalin who elaborated Lenin's cooperative plan, as we noted last time, and he did it more thoroughly and led the implementation, the full implementation of this plan. So in 1935, Stalin was able to say at the ceremony at the Academy of the Red Army on May 4th, 1935, he said, and I quote him, "The task was to transfer this country from medieval darkness to modern industry and mechanized agriculture, a serious and difficult task. The question was confronted us, the question that confronted us was, either we solve this problem in the shortest possible time and consolidate socialism in our country, or we do not solve it. Mm. In which case, our country, weak technically and unenlightened in the cultural sense, will lose its independence and become a stake in the game of the imperialist powers." Mm-hmm. So, the USSR had survived and had thrived by 1935, but he also reminded, in a different occasion, I don't remember to whom, he also reminded of this. Now, Soviet power is victorious in this country only on 1/6 of the globe, but 5/6 of the globe are in the possession of capitalist states. So, now we get to the period, and now I'm finished with that portion, because we have to get to the period of when the Nazi seized power in January of 1933, right, which, again, you know, will intensify the production of heavy industry, and naturally we'll have to be a little more careful with consumer goods. But for now, if you don't mind, we can talk about what happened as a result of the Nazi taking power in the communist world.
No, I think this is an important point. The work that was being done inside the Soviet Union at the time, though it was done independently of the global economy, both by choice and also imposed, because as Churchill had put it, the capitalist powers were looking to smother their revolution in its cradle. And so, regardless of the fact that this was happening more or less in isolation, the context was that this was, in fact, only 1/6 of the world, and the other 5/6 were, the history was moving on, and that history was leading to fascism across Europe, Germany and Italy in mm-hmm. particular.
Yes, and I think that it was precisely because of the success in the USSR that one-fifth of the world realized that something had to be done. Right. But in addition, their economic situation was very dire. So there were two important observations by the capitalist bloc, that one, the Soviet Union is surviving, amazing, and two, we are in trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Great Depression, by the way, the Depression is going on now, right?
That's right. We're in trouble. The profit rate is down. We need to go somewhere and loot something. You know, 1930s is very much like today. We have different players. You know, we have the U.S., and we have, I think the target is China. In the 30s, we have the Britain, France, and U.S., and the target was the Soviet Union and others. But anyway, to be more precise. So throughout the 1930s, the early 1930s, the first 3 years, the Soviets had pursued a policy within the League of Nations. They tried to reach an international agreement on military disarmament. So much for the Soviet Union being the aggressor. But by October 1933, Nazi Germany left the Geneva disarmament. That's 10 months after it came to power. And the Soviet initiative for disarmament really had crashed. Now, the question for the Soviet Communist Party and the Communist Parties throughout the world was how to organize the struggle against fascism and the threat of war that was clearly in the wings. Now, this question became the central topic of a very important conference, the 7th World Congress of the Communist International, the 7th Comintern, was a multinational conference which was held in Moscow from July 25th through August 20th, 1935, 2 years after the taking of power of the Nazi Party in Germany. And 1934 had been an intense year of debating what resolutions they would present, what arguments they would present at the next Comintern, which finally formed in August 1935. It had, of course, delegated representatives of ruling and non-ruling communist parties from around the world. Now, at the 7th Comintern Congress, the line which was adopted was that of the famous United Front. And the United Front meant that communist and non-communist forces would face or fight the growing menace of fascism in Europe. Now, the resolution adopted eventually by the 7th Comintern for a united front was a dramatic reversal of the Comintern's previous line, which was the line of the 6th World Congress of 1928, which was called the Third Period. It's sometimes called the Third Period, often. Now, during this third period from 1928 to the actual crisis now, the 1935-7th Comintern, during this period, communist policies were marked by a rejection, really clear rejection of political reformism. And it had a particular animosity, hostility to social democracy, and particularly, well, to social democracy core belief that there should be class cooperation with the bourgeoisie to deliver socialism gradually, sort of gradually. In 1928, the call was for a struggle of class against class, and for the overthrow of the bourgeoisie. Now, this was before the accession of fascism. And this position was preceded by an assumption deriving from, which was really too optimistic. And according to the analysis of the 1928 Comintern, what they saw in 1928 was that the world economy, the capitalist world economy, was in terrible crisis, and that from 1928 onward, there would be a time of widespread economic collapse, among the capitalist country. Right. And they thought that mass working class radicalization would occur, would intensify, would occur. So the economic and political discord would again make the time ripe for proletarian revolution, like it happened in World War during World War One.
Right.
They thought that there would be a proletarian revolution if militant policies among the communists and class antagonism were rigidly maintained by the communist vanguard parties. That's before the accession of fascism. But of course, the bourgeois democracy, the capital world, had resorted to extreme measures. You know, they resorted to backing fascism, and the first attempt, the first experiment of this extreme measure was in Italy.
That's right.
In 1919 to 1922,
right,
when Mussolini's fascist party came to power in Italy. Mind you, I mean, the proletarian had been defeated. The 1919 German Revolution was put down. The proletarian revolution in Italy, you know, all of northern Italy, Turin especially, was called the Leningrad. The Leningrad in Western Europe. It was so up in arms. Those had actually been defeated, but they had been defeated at the same time that the fascist party was rising and actually was battling in the streets against the communists.
Right.
So the experiment of fascism, if you want to call it that, experiment, manifested itself in Italy.
Yes.
And it was, of course, supported by the industrialists. That is very clear. It's a beautiful scene in 1900. Do you remember Bertolucci's 1900, which synthesizes fictionally, you know, this the coeval struggle between the socialist and the communist. On the one hand, you see the peasants, this is 1919, the socialists being expropriated of their houses. It's a beautiful sequence. And the industrialists in big fat furs and boats in the river down below, going to a church to meet and swear and contribute money to the fascist cause. It's a beautiful scene.
You know, you have an interesting set of circumstances going on here that are all these moving parts. On the one hand, at the end of World War One, you have had such a catastrophe on the European continent that very few people were in a position to explain satisfactorily, particularly to workers who did the bulk of the dying. And so you had these uprisings. Germany was the most mature economy on the European continent at that time, and its working class, consequently, was assumed by many to be the one that would lead the battle to socialism. And you had that revolution, which was put down. You had in Italy also a pretty advanced industrial proletariat, although there were some contradictions there that resembled Russia in a way in terms of the agricultural sector and backwardness and such. And you really didn't even have an Italian state until the middle of the 19th century. You had all those little city-state configurations. But you had an advanced industrial proletariat there, and Mussolini himself was in fact a communist, or at least described himself, in, you know, as that, early in his career. So you saw around 1919 the creation of fascists there, the march on Rome in 1922, and the collaboration with the adoption of this by the bourgeoisie in Italy at that time, whereas in Germany, Hitler's little beer hall putsch and his various efforts to come to power were resisted by most of the bourgeoisie until he came to power, and then he made a deal, obviously, with the bourgeoisie because they backed him strongly. He put them in control of this of the economy, and they left him in control of the state, and they essentially played both sides against the middle. And Hitler did the same thing with the workers. He had a strong working class base inside the Nazi Party, and after he got power handed to him by the guy he defeated, who defeated him in the presidential election, he had power handed to him, he turned on his working class base, Rome and them, and executed them. It was a very interesting game that was going on. All of this while the economies in the West, in Europe, and most of the world collapsed in the late 20s and early 30s, continued that collapse, and workers were rising yet again all over the world because of, you know, out of desperation, basically. And so the whole stage was set from, it was headed towards essentially workers' revolutions to this fight. They added this other element to fascism, and that required, in the eyes of the 7th Congress, and, you know, particularly, you know, Stalin and the group of people around him, that, look, this is the fate of all of us if we don't unite to stop it, and it's death for us. So that's what ended up happening.
Yes. Yes. So, but you had, there's a wonderful analysis you made there, and I'll just proceed to support it. Anyway, during that period, or the third period, the social democratic movement, for example, was held to have sabotaged the effort of the Communist Party of Germany to wage battle against fascism. This is, you know, what they're discussing before even going to the 1935 conference in Moscow, that the Communist Party of Germany had been sabotaged. It had actually looked for a cooperation with the social and was rebuffed, contrary to myths. So the communist, so they had blamed, and they were blaming, there was some blame attached to the social democratic movement for sabotaging the effort of the Communist Party of Germany to wage battle against fascism. And they did so, they claim, by propagating what the communists characterized as social democracy, anti-Marxist theory, okay, of a peaceful, democratic road to socialism among the German workers' movement. What is stopping the process of my thought here is the equivalency with the analogy with the present situation in the United States.
Yeah, Bernie Sanders, for example.
Yeah.
I mean, the question, just let me, real
go
quick,
ahead, go ahead.
You know, the question is essentially one that's posed by history, according to Marx, that the working class will take power. That means they will take ownership and control of the economy above all else. That's what it means. And social democrats of the type that we're describing say, well, no, we can do that slowly over time, but let's get pensions and let's get some health care and let's do these reforms that are essentially meant to ease and salve the contradictions that exist that agitate the working class towards the seizure of power. In other words, they are made to medicate the ills of society and to inoculate it against revolution. And that's the opposition that was the ideological basis of the opposition to it up to and through the 6th Congress.
Yes. So if we want to just define class conflict, or as it's known also as class warfare or class struggle, it is the tension of antagonism within of the antagonism which exists in society, in any class society, due to competing socioeconomic interests and desires between people of different classes. Now, the view that the class struggle provides the lever for radical social change, radical, not gradual, for the majority is central to the work of Karl Marx. And the socialists, as you said, indicated, were delaying this radicalization by the medication to which you allude. Right?
That's right.
So, now, the rise of the Nazi Party. So, yeah, okay. So between 1928 and 1933, they had this policy of class war, taking over power from the bourgeoisie, right, to be militant, to be radical. But now you had a real consolidated threat, and the rise of the Nazi Party to power in Germany in 1933 and the annihilation of the organized communist movement there shocked the Comintern into reassessing the tactics of the third period. Right. So the Popular Front policy was thus formalized as the official policy of the world communist movement. Mm-hmm. And it was officialized, of course, by the Seventh World Congress in 1935, casting aside the old third period line of class against class, in favor of and this is also important, of a new policy of, we could call it, realpolitik, using Kissinger's favorite term. And that was defending the Russian Revolution by supporting mutual defense agreements between the USSR and various capitalist states. This was the basis for what would become the alliance between the United States, Britain, France, and the Soviet Union. See how they were, you know, Stalin wasn't present at this conference. He didn't speak. But clearly, you know, there were there representatives of you know, the Kremlin.
Yes.
This is so important because it called for the unity, let's say, in Italy, in Germany, such as where unity between communists and non-communists, which couldn't be fascist, right? It had to be other kind of liberal and socialist parties. And an alliance with the actual capitalist parties that came to oppose Hitler, for whatever reason, probably because he failed to take out the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
There are too many ironies here. But all this was in a kind of seed in 1935. The major figure in the Seventh Comintern Congress was Georgi Dimitrov, the Bulgarian. And people might remember that he was a major advocate of the Popular Front. He was also one of the conspirators, one of the people accused of the conspiracy to set the Reichstag fire.
Right.
He's a great figure, but in 1934, at the trial of Leipzig against him and others, supposedly set the Reichstag fire, he was acquitted.
We're going to have to pick it up there next week. And we could start with that, as a matter of fact, and take a little deeper look at some of the other things that were going on contextually, including in Japan, for example, which was another motivator for this United Front.
Yes.
Luciana, thank you very much. A pleasure. I'm really enjoying it.
Pleasure's always mine. Thank you, Don, and thanks to your audience.
Thanks. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.